Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. You might think that a search for the best slice of pizza in Manhattan could take a lifetime, but for Colin Atrophy Hagendorf, it took exactly 2 years, 3 months, and 11 days. From 2009 to 2011, Mr. Hagendorf visited each and every one of the borough's 435 slice joints, working his way down from Inwood to the Financial District and reviewing each stop along the way on his blog, Slice Harvester. 4 years later, he has released a book with the same title in which he chronicles his journey into the heart of New York pizza, explores the role of one of the city's favorite foods and what it has played in the city's growth, and also tackles his own personal demons along the way. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm very pleased it has brought Colin Hagendorf to our show today. Hello.
Hey, thank you for having me.
When you started in 2009, what was your original plan?
There really wasn't one. I just thought, oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go eat all this pizza. No one had done it. Basically, that was it. It just happened at the right time. I saw a thing, and I saw there was a need. Someone had to eat all the pizza. No one had done it yet, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to do this.
Well, I eat pizza on a regular basis, but I can't imagine eating it every day or lunch and dinner.
Yeah, but you're – well, I didn't do that.
How often did you eat it?
I would go out once a week. Mm-hmm. And I would go with a friend, and I would eat as many pizza slices as we would share a slice at each place. We'd go to as many places as we could handle.
You limited your search to Manhattan. Some might claim that the best pizza could be found in the city's other boroughs. Do you think Manhattan pizza is the best?
No. I just think Manhattan is the – that was where I started. I was originally going to do all the boroughs, but then it became an issue of like do I – well, first of all, it got really boring writing about plain slices of pizza after I did it 373 times. And
you were limiting yourself to that because some of the best pizza is in restaurants that only sell whole pies.
Well, sure, but you need a control group, right? And this was not like a culinary endeavor for fancy gourmands or whatever. This was about schlubby Joe Schmo food, you know what I mean, just for regular humans. I was just reviewing plain pizza. It's like giving respect and elevating something that's considered lowbrow and giving it the respect that like a higher brow thing gets, I think, is important.
You mentioned that you've had a lot of grandiose ideas for projects that never got off the ground. What made you stick with this one?
Honestly, I think it was just a confluence of events. It just happened at the right time. And I think in part, like, it's the same thing people always ask me if I knew it was going to get this successful or if I had this idea that I was going to get a book out of it or anything. And I had no clue. I think people like this idea because it was a really good idea to eat all the pizza. And so I think it was just that idea that was too good to not do.
How soon did the blog start gaining attention?
Oh, almost immediately.
Because it's something – people all wonder where do you get the best slice.
Right. And so what happened was I think there's this like kind of yuppie kitchen accoutrement store on Bedford Ave in Williamsburg that a friend of mine was working at called Whisk. And she wrote about it on their
blog.
Where
even whisks cost $25 and more.
Right. And the whisk is like hand carved from marble that some dude with sleeve tattoos and a very neatly trimmed beard climbed a mountain to go chip away or whatever. She put it on the blog for the store. And then Adam Kuban, God, I've known this guy now for years. I don't know how to say his last name. I'm sorry, Adam. You're an angel, though. Adam Kuban from the blog Slice, which is the first single food-focused blog on the entire internet. It was a blog dedicated to pizza. He picked it up on Slice, and then it kind of just blew up.
And you called your blog Slice Harvester?
Yeah.
Why Harvester?
Well, my friend Greg Harvester from Alabama.
Well, you know how to pronounce his name.
He lives in San
Francisco. You don't know Kuban's name.
Yeah, I do. So Greg is an old friend of mine. He's an old punk dude, and he did a zine and played in a band called Rice Harvester for a number of years. And when I was It's like a thing that in my community of punks, everybody knows about. And when I was doing this project and it was just a thing for me and my friends and I didn't realize it was going to get all this huge success, it was just like a joke name that was referencing this zine that my friend Greg had done.
And the punk culture is a major part of your life throughout this book.
It's a major part of my life to this day.
How does one become a punk? Is it just a matter of... I've always wondered, do the tattoos come first?
I don't know. No, it's hard to say. I think, like, there's so many, you know, like any subculture or counterculture, there's so many disparate definitions of what it means. But for me, like, the sort of punk that I participate in and have been involved in is, it's about feeling, like, maybe just hypersensitive to the horrors of the world, or like feeling especially acutely aware that there's injustice and that things are terrible, and that it's kind of the responsibility of all humans to do whatever they can to make life a little better for each other.
Does pizza represent anything in punk culture?
I mean, I don't know. Pizza represents something everywhere, right? Pizza is just like, it's a nice stand-in for just like party food, right? It's just about having a good time and hanging out.
If you look for single-slice pizza places around town, the prices range from $1 a slice to $3 and even up.
Probably.
Was price something that actually determined the quality of pizza?
No, absolutely not. There is, as far as I can tell. I mean, I didn't do – maybe send like a scientist in to look at my reviews and the ratings and the prices, because I have the – I didn't notice any corresponding pattern.
And do you have certain criteria for what you think makes a good slice, I imagine? A former guest on this show said that there's usually too much cheese on a New York pizza.
Mm-hmm.
He just puts little dots of it and dots the crust with tomato sauce as well, and after it comes out of the oven, it looks great.
Who's this guy? He's like a pizza chef?
He teaches pizza making on the Lower East Side.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, I think most – I don't like a ton of cheese. You know, it's all about just a nice balance. If there's so much cheese that it's too heavy and you can't hold it, if you can't eat a slice of pizza while you walk, they did it wrong.
And when Robert Sietsma, who's a restaurant critic, mm-hmm. was on the show a few months ago, he said that a lot of the low-quality cheese comes from a mob-run farm in Wisconsin.
Cool.
So how does your rating system work?
It was pretty arbitrary. Like, I didn't even have a rating system. I think it seems like I'm a little more professional than I am because I got to write a book. But, like, in actuality, I just kind of impulsively did this thing and then made it up as I went along. So, like, I reviewed pizza all the way down to Times Square from Inwood. That's, 180 blocks of pizza or something? And that math is all wrong. But whatever, you know what I mean? For 170 blocks of pizza or something like that. And I didn't rate any of it on a scale. And it wasn't until I got to Times Square, my friend Jeff Lewis was like, hey, why don't you consider having a rating system, Colin, that I was like, oh, I guess I could do that.
Did you include service and atmosphere when you were rating?
I am more likely to assume a pizzeria is going to be good if the people in it are rude to me.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely, because I think that pizza is such like a quick convenience product, and it's more about proximity. Like in terms of business, right, it seems to be more about proximity than quality, as long as you can achieve a baseline quality. If people are nearby, they're going to buy it. And so places that have a good slice and they're like confident in their product, to use soulless language, they maybe have a tendency to not really care about customer service in a way that I find very charming.
My guest is Colin Atrophy Hagendorf. His book, Slice Harvester, a memoir in pizza. When you started, you were delivering burritos for a living.
I was.
What did a burrito delivery man's view of New York look like in 2009?
Well, I was drunk all the time, so it looked like New York looks when you're drunk. I spent most of my time riding my bike between like Crown Heights and Sunset Park and Greenpoint.
Mm.
And I lived in Williamsburg. I barely worked. My rent was $400. New York looked pretty good. You know what? It looked pretty good. I spent a lot of time at the bar. I went to a lot of punk shows. I had some good friends. It was a nice time to be alive in this city.
So what changed? Well, first of all, Williamsburg has changed a lot over the years, have become much more gentrified. And a lot of your book is about how New York is changing as much as it's about pizza.
Yeah. It's hard to pinpoint, but I was talking, it was my mother's birthday the other day, and we were out to dinner, a bunch of my family, and my aunt, who is a wonderful person, but I don't consider someone who's like especially critical of progress or gentrification. She was complaining about how New York City has become homogenous, and it could be any city, and it's not like it was when she was young. And I thought that was really indicative to me. I think it's just like, when I was a kid and I was going down to the East Village and the Lower East Side doing punk stuff as a teenager, there was like this fight going on with the older punks and some of the squatters down there that were trying to keep corporate businesses out of town, right? And that fight has been lost. And I think there is like a degree of uniqueness to the culture here that's gone.
Do you think that gentrification has changed the kind of pizza that you find in Manhattan?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think that the dollar slices are like pretty uniformly just total trash, and they are indicative of the bad priorities of late capitalism, like convenience over quality. Let's just cater to the lowest common denominator. Like, let's map this out on a piece of graph paper as a business rather than, you know, the good pizzerias pretty much are all, and this goes against my like kind of cooperative anarchist belief system or whatever, but all the good pizzerias are pretty much the work of one wingnut, totally obsessed, megalomaniacal person who had power and control issues and was like, I'm going to make this happen the way I want this to happen.
And they could be anywhere in the city.
Yeah.
Now, many places call themselves the original Rays, and many also have signs that say that they have the best slice in New York. I remember a cartoon that showed a block with four different pizza stores, and the one to the far left said the best pizza in New York. The next one said the best pizza in America. The next one said best pizza in the world, and the last one said best pizza on this block. But not every place can have the best pizza.
No, clearly. And that's like, you know, obviously there's no police force that's arbitrating whether or not that's true, right? And enforcing fines or whatever. There's a corner on First Ave, I think it's in the 80s, where there's one place on one corner that's called Best on First. And then directly across the street from it on the next corner is called like First Ave's Ultimate Pizza. And and both places are garbage. It's total junk, bad slices. But you know, everybody gets to claim that. Who cares?
Well, what about the Rays?
It's an original Rays.
But there was an original one on Prince Street, and
right.
Then
that's gone.
And now there are a whole bunch of places calling themselves Rays. Why Ray?
What's that? I have no idea. But it's that one chain, famous original Rays. Those are all a chain. They're all related.
So. Did they make decent pizza?
No, they're terrible. Any chains make garbage pizza. Famiglia, it's trash. Famous Original Rays, Little Caesars, Papa John's, garbage.
So what are the good ones? You say the good ones are the individual stores where somebody just wants to make the best pizza. What about all the stuff, the add-ons? Are they important?
I love a complicated slice. Like, I'll eat a Hawaiian slice all day. I'll eat...
You like pineapple on your pizza?
Yeah, I like pineapple on everything. Pineapple's so good. I'll eat like crumbled bacon and whatever, some chicken chunks or whatever. I'll put anything on pizza. But at the end of the day, if a place can't make a good plain slice, they're not going to make the other stuff good.
This also comes across as a kind of a social thing. You say you went around with a friend, and then you met your girlfriend Tina in the early days of the blog.
Yes.
Are you still together?
No, we're not.
Did you break up over pizza?
Nah. No, we just kind of grew apart. I don't know. Like, we dated for a half a decade, and we both, are much better people having come out of that relationship, but we kind of grew to be people that did not need to be dating each other anymore.
You gave an poor to average reviews for most of the pizza places in New York. What's your take on pizza outside of the city? People swear by Frank Pepe's in New Haven. Chicagoans just adore deep dish pizza.
I don't think that's true, actually. I've never been to Chicago, but I have a lot of friends from Chicago and that have lived in Chicago, and I am under the impression that actual Chicago residents think deep dish is a trap for tourists and don't eat that. But I think there's a New Haven makes good pizza. I think you can extend the pizza, like the decency of pizza, to the entire tri-state area, right? Like southeastern Connecticut, Jersey for sure has good pizza.
But you say the best pizza you found in New York was from a place called Pizza Suprema?
Absolutely.
What did they do that's different? How did they perfect their slice?
I couldn't have lucked out better by picking a place with more narrative tension or like a better dramatic arc to have turned out to be my favorite slice.
Where is it?
It's on 8th Avenue between 30th and 31st Street, just south of the 31st. Like two stores off the corner, maybe. Maybe it's right on the corner, actually. I can't remember now. It's been there since the mid-60s, since 1965. And the guy that owned the place, Sal Riggio, he opened that place, and for 20 years he only made plain slices of pizza. And his son, he passed away in 2003, and his son Joe, who has since become a friend of mine through the process of writing the book and sitting down and interviewing him about his family, he runs it now. But for 20 years, Sal Riggio only made plain pizza, and he said, I'm going to make the best slice of plain pizza. That's my intention. And didn't get any acknowledgement. He got a little minor acknowledgement from some like peripheral stuff. But then, you know, to have me come around and eat every slice and end up feeling like that was my favorite one seems like a pretty intense justification of that life's work or whatever.
Didn't Pizza Suprema have a relationship with an old favorite of yours in the East Village, St.
Mark's
Pizza?
Oh, yeah.
So that one's pretty good, too?
Growing up, St. Mark's Pizza was my jam. That was my favorite slice.
So what's next? Are you going to sample all the burritos in Manhattan, or are you going to eat all the pizza in Brooklyn or the Bronx? Staten Island has some pretty great pizza.
I'm going to get a half-fried chicken, half-fried rice from every Chinese takeaway in all of the Bronx.
Are you serious?
No, that's disgusting. No, I'm not going to do anything remotely like this ever again. This was really fun, but I think that it's not worth, just trying to rehash. I do have a podcast now, if it's okay if I talk about it.
Of course.
Called Radio Harvester. It's on iTunes, where I interview people about their projects and the punk stuff that they do in pizzerias. I think it's pretty fun.
And are you still eating a lot of pizza, or isn't there a point where you just say, I'm going to have to take a real vacation, move on to something else?
No, I never overdid it. See, that's the thing. I didn't eat it every day. I didn't eat it for every meal. I ate pizza once a week when I was doing Slice Harvester. Now I still eat pizza. Yeah, I ate pizza the other night. I like pizza. Pizza's really good food. That's why I did this, because I love pizza genuinely and sincerely.
But you also you say on your book that while eating pizza, you're working to dismantle systematic structures of oppression. We're talking pizza here, aren't we?
Yeah, well, you know, the kind of subtitle of the book is what we talk about when we talk about pizza, right? Like, that's because it culturally, right, I come from like kind of a secular Jewish New York tradition. And what do? You eat food. I was talking about this the other night at dinner with my parents. Every meal we have, we talk about other meals that we've had. Only if we're enjoying the food we're having, we talk about other meals we've enjoyed.
Colin Atrophy Hagendorf, his book Slice Harvester, A Memoir in Pizza, is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for coming by. I suspect that this joint on 8th Avenue in the 30s is going to suddenly have a run on its pizza.
I hope so. It's so surreal to see your face and hear your voice, by the way. I've listened to this show forever. This is great.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Chameleons and their color-changing skins have been objects of fascination since the days of Aristotle. From their long, lightning-fast tongues to their telescopic vision eyes, there's much more about the colorful reptile that remains a mystery to scientists. In an article called True Colors, the Colorful Language of Chameleons, Patricia Edmonds looks at how chameleons use color to communicate and how slash-and-burn agriculture destroys their habitats and threatens their future in the wild. It's in the September issue of National Geographic, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Patricia Edmonds to our show today. Hello.
Leonard, hi, how are you?
I'm well. Chameleons sound to me like they are endangered, but I'm okay. Many people believe that chameleons take on the color of whatever they touch in order to blend into their surroundings. Is that true?
It is not true, notwithstanding what you might see on a house paint commercial that is airing on television from time to time. There are a couple of misunderstandings about chameleons that have been put to rest just by very recent science. There was some research that was reported earlier this year that says chameleons, in fact, have a couple of layers of skin, and they each have some different contribution to make to the color change process. So there are other animals whose skins change color, some fish, frogs, octopus, and that's largely because there are pigments in their skin cells that may disperse out through little cell extensions and change their color when they're excited or aggressive, and then condense back into one spot and the color changes back again. That happens with chameleons, but that can't be the only reason that chameleons change color, because there's no green pigment in a chameleon, and so many of the most vivid ones, in fact, are green. So what the scientists from University of Geneva did was looked literally a little deeper. They looked under that layer of skin cells that have pigments in them to a layer where they found these nano-sized crystals. And those crystals, in fact, are in a grid that can be tuned, if you will, by the animal, so that the crystals are farther apart or closer together, and that allows different wavelengths of light to pass through, and that's what causes the color change. So, for example, there's an exquisitely colorful species called a panther chameleon. When one of the guy panther chameleons decides to encroach upon the territory of the other guy panther chameleon, the first step in the showdown is for them to get just as colorful as they possibly can and try to intimidate the other one. So if they're largely green when they're in their resting state, then I saw a great example of one of them moving toward another one, and encroaching chameleon gets as red as he possibly can. But the other guy's actually a little bigger, a little bit more alpha male, and he turns the most insane array of yellow and yellow-orange to the point that the encroaching chameleon says, "That's it, I can't beat you." And at that point, his colors go dark. And all this is about aggression and intimidation, and it all has to do with the wavelengths of light that are reflecting off these tiny little crystals in their skin.
Do other color-changing animals have these kinds of crystals? Are the chameleons the only ones?
There are other skin structures that they're not exactly the same as the guanine crystals that are in chameleons, but there's some other color change structures that are similar, but the chameleon is the one that's probably got the most dramatic example of this particular crystal grid array.
And you write, for sheer breadth of freakish anatomical features, the chameleon has few rivals. What other physical features set the chameleon apart from other lizards?
Well, I have to say, the one that most people are probably as familiar with as the color change is the eyes that swivel in like little turret-type constructions on their face. If you try to meet a chameleon's eyes, good luck to you, because they are literally swiveling independently each of the other. It gives them the most phenomenal vision, and that great vision, even at distance, is the way that they use another one of their bizarre little anatomical advantages, which is a tongue that is far longer than the lizard's body. It can literally shoot out in a nanosecond to catch something that it wants to eat and then retract just as quickly. It can shoot at about twice the length of the animal's body, and it's quite something to behold. I was fortunate to visit with some chameleon breeders who allowed me to see the animals snagging some flies that were, two or three body lengths away almost, and they did it just in less than a blink of an eye.
And your article has online links to a video of the chameleon tongue projections. I'm talking to Patricia Edmonds, whose article, True Colors, The Colorful Language of Chameleons, is in the September issue of National Geographic magazine, filled with all sorts of surprises, including that chameleons have two different names in Afrikaans. Afrikaans because chameleons are native to Africa?
Well, about 42% of the chameleon species that we know of, and there are more being discovered all the time, but currently scientists identify about 202, and literally 42% of them are found on the island of Madagascar off Africa. Most of the rest of them live on the African continent. And the person who shared with me the various names of them is a National Geographic grantee. Her name is Crystal Tolley, and she's a researcher who has done a lot of work in South Africa identifying chameleons. And so it came to her attention that in Afrikaans, they had a couple of different names for them, which would be quite unpronounceable for someone like me, but the translations are charming. One of them means colorful little men, which is about right, and the other means treading carefully, because another one of the bizarre characteristics of these lizards is the way they walk. It's almost, it's applauding, and it's one step forward, but then I kind of sway back, and I sway from side to side and frontward. And the advantage that gives them is when prey is trying to see them, or predators, sorry, are trying to see them in the trees, they don't look like an animal running a straight line that would catch a predator's eye. They look like a branch or a leaf swaying in the trees. So their evolutionary adaptations are fascinating.
How different are the different species of chameleon? There's over 200 or so?
There are. And the differences are in size. There are tiny, tiny ones that the body is less than an inch long. And then there are some that are roughly 2 feet long. There are all manner of color combinations, including some that are like the colorful parrots of the chameleon family, and others that are just sort of mottled brown and fit in beautifully with the forest floors that they often live on. In fact, one of the researchers talked about how chameleons, when they're being hunted, don't so much play dead as that they play leaf, because this chameleon will see, say, a bird or something coming at it, and it will drop to the forest floor and kind of curl up. And I've seen images in which I cannot find the chameleon because it looks for all the world like a leaf.
You're right that the lizards often die on the journey from the African continent to Western laboratories. Must they stay in Africa or Madagascar? Doesn't that make them more difficult to study?
I think what the point of that one was, a long time ago when individuals were first trying to study them, they could hardly transport them in a safe and healthy way. Probably that's a little bit easier today, but unfortunately, there's a pet trade or people who would like to send them from Madagascar or South Africa for pet sales who are often not particularly careful about that, and the animals still die in that way. And this is why there are international bans and restrictions and policies on their sale and transport from other countries. But they can be bred safely and healthfully and humanely in the United States, and that is why I got a chance to see as many species of them as I did in the exotic locale of Reading, Pennsylvania, because I visited there with someone who's got all manner of different species from different continents.
You found that chameleons actually live longer in captivity. They'll live a dozen years in captivity, less than half of that in the wild. Isn't that a surprise?
It is, except when you think about the threats, and of course they have the age-old threats. They have pretty much as soon as chameleons are hatched or born. Some come out of eggs, some are live born. But pretty much at that point, they are on their own. Chameleons do no parenting. So they may be snatched up by a bird or a snake. They are now, unfortunately, falling to human activity with increasing frequency. The habitats may be so small for a given species that it is literally a single mountaintop where a single species might live. And if agriculture keeps taking out the trees on that mountaintop, their habitat is smaller and smaller, and so is their chance of surviving. There are maybe a third, slightly more than a third of all chameleon species that are to some degree endangered. There are nine that have been listed by the international ranking body as critically endangered. There are another 37 that are endangered and others that are vulnerable or near threatened. So,
are there anything? Is there anything we can do to protect these endangered chameleons?
Well, I think that's what the researchers that we talked with are all about at this point. They're trying to at least make the nations where these animals live aware of trying to leave a little bit more space where they can survive. We have some researchers who are going to be going back to an area where they knew one species lived and lived there alone and check and see if it might still be there. And if it is, I think they hope to transplant it perhaps to a habitat where it might continue. I think awareness is a large part of it because the researchers understand that if you want to leave a forest for a lizard to live in it or raise a forest so you'll have a little bit more land to grow food for your family, that's a decision where you'll probably err on the side of your family, and yet we certainly don't want to see these fascinating oddball creatures disappear from the earth.
A listener is curious about whether chameleons can see colors. You said earlier that one turned bright yellow and scared off the other one, so must see something there.
Yes, I think they have got some of the... I've seen descriptions of them that suggest they've got some of the best vision of any creature extant. So, yes, they see these colors, and in fact, in the magazine, there's a splendid photograph. Our photographer, Christian Ziegler, spent a good amount of time in Madagascar and got tremendous photos of some of the behaviors, including the one where two similar chameleons face off and have sort of a vivid color fight. And when one realizes that he cannot prevail, he just goes muddy brown, and the other character is still wearing this very intimidating shade of red. So, yes, they can see and react to colors which are shows of aggression, which are also courtship displays. So if a gentleman chameleon wants to impress a lady chameleon, he may put on a vivid array of colors. And then once the chameleons have mated and the female is carrying eggs, she, if she's approached by another amorous male, will put on just these bright and dark colors that say, get away from me, I am not interested right now. And that usually tends to dissuade the suitors, or if not, and they keep coming at her, she will hiss or bite him.
And you witnessed some of that, as you said, in Reading, Pennsylvania, where a man named Nick Henn, a hobbyist and a breeder, keeps as many as 200 chameleons. One of his chameleons, named Katy Perry, turned salmon pink when she was ready to mate. Would that always be the color that a female would turn?
Not necessarily. This is a panther chameleon tends to have that sort of behavior. Not all the chameleon species have the same.
And why are they called panthers? They're not black.
They're not. Why someone gave them, they go by scientific names, but why someone gave them that common name is actually not known to me. That's a very good question that I probably should have asked in my reporting. But the panthers are the ones that have some of the widest arrays of colors, and their females especially look all pretty in pink when they are available for mating, and after that are putting on a coat that says, no thanks.
And Ember, a young male panther chameleon, turned a brighter shade of red when he got grumpy. So they're sending out all sorts of different communications through their color.
They are. Yeah, that's exactly what their color changes are about. So it might be aggression. It might be feeling threatened. But they can then turn altogether dark when they want to hide or want to say, okay, that's it, I'm backing off.
These animals rile each other. That's the word that's used. And you write that hen places the males where they can't see the females or rival males. Are chameleons
That's right.
easily riled?
Yes. It's fascinating because he literally has cages upon cages that he has put in rows in just a certain way so that the female can't see the male or the male can't see the other male, because their eyesight is so good that if they have a sight line to each other, that might be enough to put them in a sort of an agitated state, and that, of course, has cost to their well-being. So he's put a lot of effort, and I think most conscientious breeders put a lot of effort into giving a healthy and a compatible with their needs sort of habitat for them. They've got a nice humid environment, they've got nice warm lights to stay under, and they are not put anywhere that they will see creatures that will get them agitated.
If I were to set a pair of chameleons free in my Brooklyn backyard, would they be able to survive?
I'm going to say no, and I don't mean this as any knock against Brooklyn. I know that in the United States there are chameleons that live in Florida, but I think they probably require that kind of a climate. In Florida, they tend to be able to range around backyards and feed themselves, but this is not the most common habitat. There are montane, mountain-dwelling versions as well, but again, I'm not thinking of Brooklyn as a mountainous habitat, so I think you may not be able to populate your backyard with these characters.
I'm guessing that they also might be in danger from all the birds that
yes, birds,
we would have
snakes,
in my backyard.
Yeah, cats, one would imagine. Mm. I think when the ones that have lived in Florida have had to worry about domestic predators as well.
So we now know that chameleons don't change color to camouflage themselves, but actually as a form of communication.
Yes, and it does serve something of a camouflage purpose. I mean, they actually have several things that they are able to do to hide themselves, and some of them have colorations have developed and evolved over time to have colorations that work well and allow them to blend in better in the areas where they live. But there are also movements that they use to blend in and an actual ability to flatten their bodies vertically. If you can imagine, their spine sort of rises up higher and their sides compress in tighter so that they are a much taller and narrower animal than when you first saw them. And they are able to do that because they've got ribs with a hinge in the middle that literally the ribs can sort of move out into a V shape or straighten out into a straight shape and make the animal no wider than a branch. So if the chameleon is standing on the top of a branch, he hears the fluttering of wings and he's not interested in having that bird see him. He can literally swivel around to the underside of the branch and compress his sides so that he is no wider than the branch and he's invisible behind it.
Patricia Edmonds' article, True Colors, The Colorful Language of Chameleons, is in the September issue of National Geographic. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It was my pleasure. Thanks, Leonard.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Richard W. Matt and David Sweat escaped from the Clinton Correctional Facility in northern New York this past June, it was the beginning of not only a manhunt, but also a catalog of brutality against prisoners that included being beaten while handcuffed, choked, and slammed against cell walls and bars. Sadly, as New York Times reporters Michael Weinrip and Michael Schwartz found, that kind of treatment is not confined to the Clinton facility. In an article headlined, Prison Guard Beat-Up Squad is Blamed in New York Inmate's Death, they document the brutal murder of Samuel Harrell, an inmate at the Fishkill Correctional Facility who had a history of erratic behavior linked to bipolar disorder and was beaten to death in Building 21 on the evening of April 21st. The story appeared in the August 18th edition of the Times. I'm very pleased that it brings Michael Weinrip to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me, Leonard. I appreciate it.
Well, you already investigated the death of Samuel Harrell at the Fishkill Correctional Facility when David Sweat and Richard W. Mann escaped?
No, it didn't go that far back. But we did, my colleague, Michael Schwartz, heard from a source at Rikers, which we covered for over a year, that an inmate died under mysterious circumstances. This was way back in April at Fishkill. And we started making calls in it way back then, but we couldn't get any traction. We got no information from the state police or the Department of Correction.
And as we will learn through during this conversation, there's good reason why you couldn't get that information. People are afraid to talk.
Yes, they're very afraid to talk. The state prisons haven't been looked at for decades, really closely, by reporters. Here and there, there's been some, but nothing extensive. And they don't. There's no sort of microscope on them the way there is for Rikers, the city jails.
Which also has been troubled.
Yes.
Why was Samuel Harrell in prison?
Samuel Harrell was in prison for drug dealing. It was his third time he was serving a prison sentence. He was due out in 2020. Or that was his first chance to get out. He had no history of violence. They were all drug dealing convictions. And within prison, when he had infractions, and he broke the rules, it was never for something violent. He might have drug possession. He might have disobeyed an order verbally. But he had no violent history at all.
Why did he announce that he was leaving prison on the night of April 21st?
Well, that's impossible to know, but he was bipolar, and he had a history when he went off his medication of behaving erratically. For example, we interviewed his wife and his sister, and they talked about how when he was off his medication, was psychotic, he'd walk around the house turning around pictures and photographs because he thought they were staring at him. He also thought the TV was talking to him. So clearly, if you decide and you have 5-6 years left on your prison sentence that you pack your bags and you're going to leave, something is wrong.
And his mother had died in November. He was depressed about that.
Yes, that's what inmates told us.
Now, the guards must have known that he had psychological problems. How did they respond to him?
Well, initially it sounds like it, and I need to qualify this, Leonard. We're outsiders. We're reporters. And we tried so hard to get the department to speak with us, to get the corrections officers to speak with us. We would find their cell phones and call them. And we weren't able to do it. No one responded. So this is something we pieced together. But according to our sources, a couple of the officers tried to do the right thing. When he started to act up, they called mental health and medical services and asked for someone to come and help him, but no one came. And then apparently what happened is two more officers came to the scene because he was agitated. And what a couple of inmates told us is he got so nervous and unnerved, surrounded by the four officers, that he just bolted. Now, he's not leaving the prison. He's within a prison hallway. But he just bolted, and they went charging after him.
And then they threw him to the ground, handcuffed him. And you found that as many as 20 officers began to kick and punch him, including members of the so-called beat-up squad.
Yes.
Is that a name that has been around for a while?
Well, you know what's interesting is there's a group called the Correctional Association, and they've been in the prisons for 170 years, and it's their job. They're inmate advocates, but they are actually sanctioned by the state to monitor the prisons and how inmates are treated. 3 years before this incident, they singled out in a report this building, Building 21 at Fishkill, and this shift of officers, which was the 3-11 shift, as part of a group of officers that the inmates complained about, and they actually identified them as a beat-up squad. We also had grievances that were filed before that talked about how these guys were sort of a posse who went around beating up prisoners. So it's not like it was unknown to the state.
And I'm assuming the supervisors at Fishkill were aware of the group. Do we know if there were similar squads in other prisons?
You know, we've only reported in these two prisons and in Fishkill and Clinton. We do know that inmates in Clinton, where the escape was, described being rounded up by officers from specialized unit like the CERT unit, which transports prisoners, and being beaten there. But
and some of those were in an honor section of the prison.
Yes, at Clinton, they were all on our section, which means most of them, it's a maximum security prison, so most of them had committed very serious crimes, but they had clean records for years and years, so they had earned the right to move around more freely.
And because those guys broke out of prison, they were then put into solitary confinement after they were beaten?
First, they were questioned. The correction officers were sort of hell-bent on trying to get to the bottom of the escape, which is good. You know, they wanted to. But according to our sources, they put plastic bags over inmates and threatened to waterboard them. They choked them. They punched them. They kicked them. In the process of trying to get information. Now, the irony in Clinton was that the only people implicated there have not been inmates. They have been correction officers. Nine have been suspended. One has been criminally charged. A civilian has pleaded guilty to a criminal smuggling in weapons. And the top administration has been moved. So after they went through all this, they were allegedly beaten up. They were removed to a prison called Upstate, nearby, which is totally solitary confinement, and without being told any reasons or any due process, they were locked up in solitary for about 3 weeks.
And the only people implicated in the escape are prison employees. One's already pled guilty to aiding the escape. Another faces criminal charges. Nine officers have been suspended, and the leadership of the prison has been removed.
Right, right.
So, but they just assumed that because Sweat and Matt were in this area and in the tailoring section of the prison, that everybody would know about their plans?
Well, ultimately what investigators decided was that these correction officers, many of them, instead of doing their hourly, nightly rounds, were sleeping on the job. They would go into their offices, turn off the lights, and sleep from the 11 o'clock at night to 5 in the morning when they were supposed to do inspections of the cells. So our theory on this, and again, it's very difficult, we're outsiders, was that they were so concerned that they would be exposed for this kind of wrongdoing and breaking of the rules that they were just really, you know, determined to beat the truth out of these guys.
My guest is Michael Weinrip, who has written 5 different columns at the New York Times over his nearly 30 years there, Our Towns, On Sunday, On Education, 3 times, Parenting, Generation B. Also, he's been a staff writer with the magazine, an investigative reporter, written about national politics and metro politics, and was the deputy metro editor. And he and Michael Schwartz have been covering the prisons recently. Their article headlined "Prison Guard Beat Up Squad is Blamed in New York Inmate's Death" was in the August 18th edition of the New York Times. And it's about this man named Samuel Harrell, who's black. He was also subjected, according to reports, to racial slurs. And it was reported that he was beaten like he was a trampoline.
Yes, that's
what. Who said that?
A couple of the inmates that we interviewed. In that case, we had affidavits from about, I think it was about 17 inmates that we obtained through the lawyer representing the family. And we had 3 who were willing to speak to us on the record with their names, which when you're in prison is a big risk. And what they essentially described him is him being handcuffed and laid on the floor. And once that happens, there may be justification with wrestling someone who's being violent to the floor. But once they're handcuffed, I think it's pretty safe to assume they're not going to do any damage. And what the inmates told us is they kicked them and they punched them. They shouted racial epithets. And they took him and threw him down the stairs.
And one inmate reported seeing him on the landing bent in an impossible situation with his eyes open, but the eyes weren't looking at anything. What was the impossible position?
I can't say exactly. I don't know. I assume what he was talking about was just twisted in this way that no human being, if they were alive, would normally be twisted. We think there's a good chance that when they threw him down the stairs, he was already dead. That's just an educated guess. And one of the things, it was almost, the way it was described to us, almost a Keystone Cop situation that wasn't funny, where after he was down the stairs, he was a big man, about 250 pounds, over 6 feet tall. They tried to get him into a wheelchair to roll him out of there, and he kept sliding out of the wheelchair. And they put a sheet over his head, and finally a bunch of them wheeled him out.
And then they called for an ambulance.
Yes, they called for an ambulance.
Did they offer any explanation as to how he had died?
Well, the union for the officers told us that they suspected it was K2, synthetic marijuana. And we were told by correction officials, state correction officials, to reserve judgment until the autopsy report came out. Because what they sort of implied was that this was a man who was acting up because he was acting crazy on K2, which can do that to you. You can get very violent on K2. And that he resisted, and so the officers had to respond in a violent way. When we finally got the autopsy report, there was no K2 in the system.
Just antidepressants and some tobacco.
That's right. He was also, it was ruled a homicide. Now, a homicide's a tricky word. It doesn't mean you've committed murder if there's a homicide. A homicide means that the cause of death is related to human beings, and it can be a medical term or a criminal term. And he also had cuts and bruises all over his body.
And he actually died of cardiac arrhythmia.
Yes, yes. As I said, he's a young guy. He's 30 years old and a big guy, and it's possible, or what appears from the autopsy is whatever happened to him set off this heart or exacerbated this heart problem and resulted in his death.
So has there been a formal investigation into the death of Mr. Harrell? Have any of the officers been disciplined as a result?
There is an investigation going on. The state police have told us they're going to refer it to the district attorney. The union has told us that there have been no disciplinary actions taken, and that there isn't even anyone who's put on modified leave. Now, at Rikers Island, if you commit some sort of involved in some sort of questionable use of force, you will often be placed on modified leave. Here, according to the union, not even that happened.
And you found that that several prisoners have been punished since Mr. Harrell's death, and they've been put into solitary confinement and threatened with violence if they speak out about what they know?
Yes, we were told that nine had served time in solitary confinement since. And that some, on the day this all happened, were told, you know, were thrown or pushed into a corner and said, "You didn't see anything, and if you say anything, you won't get home." That sort of thing.
William J. Connolly, Fishkill superintendent, resigned this month. Do you believe that was connected to Mr. Harrell's death?
The state says no. It's hard to know. The state says he'd served a long time and was ready to retire, but. At very least, the timing of stepping down seems questionable.
I'm speaking with Michael Weinrip of the New York Times. He has written with Michael Schwartz, "Prison Guard Beat-Up Squad is Blamed in New York Inmate's Death," which was in the August 18th edition of the Times, a startling article. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Michael Weinrip, and we are talking about problems in our prisons. He and Michael Schwartz wrote an article that was published in the August 18th edition of the Times called "Prison Guard Beat-Up Squad is Blamed in New York Inmate's Death." As I understand it, in the city jails, there are video cameras. Are there any in the state jails?
In the city jails, there are thousands of video cameras, and under a federal order that the city system is coming under, there are going to be thousands more. So if something happens in a hallway, it will be picked up on camera. Much of the state system has no video cameras. The two prisons where we reported our stories, Clinton and Fishkill, had no video cameras in the area. If there were video cameras in Clinton, at very least in the hallway, they would have seen that the correction officers weren't doing their rounds, which was a big problem. In the case of Samuel Harrell, they would have. This was a hallway. You can't look into a cell because of privacy reasons, but you can put a camera in a hallway, and there were none there. And it's many of the state prisons, including the older maximum security, have no cameras.
Some of the officers involved in the death include a woman named, only known as Ms. B. Have these people, Robert Michels, Thomas Dickerson, John Yeager, Brian Yule, Ms. B., worked at the prison for a long time?
We only have a limited knowledge of their background. I mean, we can go online, find their names, verify their salaries and their recent experience with the state. So most of them, yes. We also go on their Facebooks, for example. And one of the tough things as a reporter is you work so hard to be fair. And you go onto one of these Facebooks and you see these are human beings, these officers. They have children. They have families. And it's a painful thing to write these kinds of stories out of people who are, they have generous lives, at least other parts of their lives.
There's a 60-year-old ranking officer, Sergeant Joseph Guarino, who has a long history of complaints that were filed against him. Is he considered the leader of the beat-up squad?
Well, we don't know if he was the leader, but he was the senior officer there. And we actually were able to reach him by cell and confirm just briefly that he was there. He was willing to say he was there. And we do know that he was involved in at least two major beat-ups in the past where the state settled the cases for $60,000 and $65,000. At a deposition, he talked about his nickname being Sergeant Search-A-Lot. And he also talked about having about 30 grievances a year against him. And that's a lot of grievances compared to the number that usually get filed. Now, I just want to say, Leonard, these are hard stories to do because we don't get the other side of this. You know, we work so hard. We ask the union. We ask the state. We have our researchers find these people. We get them on cell phones, and they won't comment. So if they have a different point of view, we don't get to hear it.
But isn't that their responsibility if they want their story to be told, if they feel that they're being unfairly accused?
You would think so. I can understand why an officer would not talk to a reporter, but you would think that the Department of Corrections would at least supply a narrative of what they feel happened. And we can't get that out of them. We ask, we'll send a list that takes us half a day to compile of questions and ask them for a response. And we get a one-paragraph answer saying they're investigating. And this is a public agency. I think that the State Corrections Department owes the public more than that. And if they think we are wrong, they ought to say it.
You spoke to some other inmates. David Martinez, an inmate who's serving time for attempted murder, filed a grievance saying that he was being assaulted and harassed by officers and that they were going around and beating people up. Why was he targeted?
It's hard to know these things. First of all, it's a he said. But also, it can be a small thing. It can be a correction officer being irritated. It can be the inmate saying something, swearing at him or something, saying the wrong kind of thing or looking at him the wrong way or, spitting on him. So you don't know what sets these things off. But it seems pretty clear that the response is out of proportion to what set it off.
And then another inmate, Ricky Rodriguez, said that officers beat him so severely he lost his two front teeth and had to be hospitalized.
Yes, Mike Schwartz, my partner, interviewed him on the day that he came out of prison. He'd been in a hospital prison after he was beaten, and we saw the pictures, and he has bruises all over him. He was very, very badly beaten, and he told Michael, my reporting partner, that it was some of the same officers involved.
Piecing together these stories, you actually had to go to relatives and others because the inmates often were afraid to talk, but they have written to relatives or spoken to them on the phone?
Well, you sort of piece this together. We did a number of things. We had letters from some of them with their names signed. This is in both the Clinton and the Fishkill story. We could also talk to them by phone. We put in accounts. You give a credit card and you put an account at a prison so they can call you on their dime. And then we went and visited these people in the prisons. We actually drove around the state, Mike Schwartz and I, and visiting hours went in and talked to the prisoners. Now, under state rules, you can't take notes when you go in as a visitor, but we're just trying to
And why are those rules in effect?
I don't know.
Not taking notes?
They say security. I don't know. It's also true in the jails, although the jails are much better about arranging an interview than the state is. But whatever reason, they say security. So as an aside, any time you hear that so-and-so said something in a jailhouse interview and you see a long quote, be skeptical.
If somebody has either pieced it together or that been told to say that?
In that case, I was talking about a direct quote saying all that. Generally, I mean, what we do is we talk to these guys and we run out and we write down everything we remembered. We don't quote them directly because we can't remember a quote like that.
You couldn't record it on your cell phone?
No. We're not allowed to bring a cell. You can't bring a cell phone into a state prison.
My guest is Michael Weinrip of the New York Times. We're talking about what goes on in state prisons, which, as you point out, is different than city prisons. Not that the city prisons and jails aren't also troubled. I'm assuming to some degree this is also because a certain environment takes place in any workplace. And even the nicest guy in the world entering into an environment where there's a lot of violence will eventually just join in because there's a certain amount of peer pressure.
Well, first of all, being a correction officer is a really hard job. On some levels, it's the most violent, uniformed position. On other levels, there hasn't been a correction officer who's been killed in the line of duty at the Rikers Jail, according to the Department of Corrections, since 1975. Now, in that time, there have been 250 police officers killed in the line of duty.
In other parts of the city.
In other parts of the city. The old transit cops, the police officers walking the beat. And as an aside, a part of that is guns. They don't allow guns in the prison. But people say to us, the union reps say to us, most of these guys are good. And I agree with them 100%. The vast majority of correction officers are good. The problem is there's a culture of saying nothing. So it only takes a few bad guys who do the beat-ups, and then everybody lies on the use of force reports, and nobody says anything. And unless there's some extraordinary situation, the beating goes undiscovered.
And also in their defense, something you've kind of hinted at, they're dealing with a lot of very bad people in these prisons.
Without question. When we write these stories, we always talk about what a person is in for. We'll quote John Smith by name and we'll say he's been convicted of murder. Or he's been convicted of rape. There's no question, especially at Clinton, which was a maximum security prison, everybody was in for a serious, serious felony, often murder. But some of these people, like at Clinton, had been in a long time in prison, had clean records, and so had earned a position on the honors block. Now, how you feel about someone who's committed murder 25 years later talks a lot about what you are as a human being. If you don't believe people can be reformed, if your family member has been a victim of that kind of crime, you will never forgive.
But studies indicate that as people get older, they're less likely to do the kinds of things that they did when they were young.
Also, the studies indicate the lowest recidivism rate for inmates who are paroled into the community are people who commit murder.
This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopez talking to Michael Weinrip of the New York Times. I'm wondering why so many of these stories of abuses are coming out now and haven't in the past.
Well, I think there's, you know, it's like shark sightings. Once there are a few, there are more, and once there are more, there are more. Sometimes that can be a bad thing, but I think in this case it's good. I think at this moment the country's eye is on prisons in the same way it's on racially involved shootings involving police officers. And solitary confinement, for example, is a very big issue now. So I think that there is an appetite for these stories. And we're at a moment. What's interesting, Leonard, is both conservatives and liberals agree, Republicans and Democrats, that there are too many people in prison, that a lot of the offenses that are nonviolent, like drug dealing, should not be punished this way and with this kind of time. And so I think all that, because it's one of the rare things with this uniformity across the political spectrum, has given the public an appetite to pay attention to these things.
After the Times published reports about the abuse, the Corrections Department released a statement saying the inmate complaints had been under investigation for several weeks. You said none of the officers involved have been put on leave. What would an investigation ultimately lead to?
Well, it could lead to a lot of things. It could lead to nothing. It could lead to internal disciplinary action. Now, one of the frustrating things from a reporter's point of view or the public's point of view is those internal disciplinary records are not public, so you don't know how a person has been punished. Or it could lead to criminal charges, which virtually never happens. Tom Robbins is a great reporter, did a piece for the Marshall Report talking about how three correction officers at Attica who were alleged to have beat up an inmate there were actually prosecuted, and that had almost never happened in the state system.
Are prisoners at the Clinton Correctional Facility being protected during the investigation?
A lot of them have been moved. And the unfortunate thing about that is they closed down the honors block at Clinton, and they moved. We talked to guys who were at Shawangunk, who were at Sing Sing. Those prisons don't have honor blocks. These guys at Clinton, after 20, 25 years, had got good jobs at these at the prisons and the tailor shops and all.
And they were making art, as we discovered.
Well, they were making art, which cut two ways. But some of these guys were making with overtime as much as $90 every 2 weeks, which doesn't sound like a lot on the outside, but it was a lot on the inside. And we interviewed a guy who had a job like that, and he was transferred to Sing Sing, and he was now working as a porter and making $6 every 2 weeks.
Governor Cuomo initially said that he'd be shocked if any New York prison employees were implicated in the escape of Richard Matt and David Sweat. Has his office responded to your reporting?
Very little. It's funny. The city, it took a while, but the city is very responsive to our reports and other reporters' stories. The mayor has had several press conferences about the issues at Rikers over the last year. The commissioner, Joseph Pont, almost always would give us an interview when we requested one. On the state, we can't get an interview with the head of the acting commissioner, Anthony Annucci. And we can't get the governor's office to say anything beyond we're investigating.
Whenever I do a segment like this, I always get a couple of email responses from listeners who say, if you don't want to do the time, don't do the crime.
They're right, on one level. When you start doing this reporting and you envision what life is like in a prison where you're locked away for 25 or 30 years, especially with as a visitor, you go in, you see this environment, and you walk out, and you see the prison is just a building out in a beautiful setting often. Sing Sing's on the river there, the Hudson River, and these people are kept locked inside. So my number one advice is don't commit a crime. But once someone is in for a crime, if they keep acting violent inside, they need stronger punishment. But once they're in for a crime and they're following the rules, they deserve to be treated like human beings, in my opinion.
When you publish stories like this, do you start hearing from other inmates who then feel that their stories have to be told as well?
Yes, we do. One thing we hear a lot of is I'm in prison for this crime and I didn't commit it. Now, I'll be honest with you, we just don't have the resources to investigate that kind of thing.
And we hear often nobody in prison, or practically nobody in prison, committed the crime that they've been accused of.
Right, right. But one of the, what is impressive is one of the guys who is a key source for our story on the Clinton prison beat-ups, a guy named Patrick Alexander, was very open. He told us, I screwed up, I killed my neighbor, and I'm doing my time. I've been in here for, you know, 15 years. So it's not universal, although an awful high percentage didn't do it.
Michael Weinrip and Michael Schwartz, their article, Prison Guard Beat-Up Squad is Blamed in New York Inmates' Death, appeared in the August 18th edition of the New York Times. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Leonard, it's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.